stage, but there's a lot of really good and exciting music making that takes place. And it's great to see on the first half, the youngest ones who have never been on the stage before go out there and, you know, they're looking and they see all those people and how big it is. It's cute all in itself to see that.
I don't know if this will throw you, David, but I'm just curious now that you mention it. What's the age of the oldest Portland Youth Philharmonic alumnus?
I'm not entirely sure, but again, we're talking close to at least 80 years old.
Incredible.
Because of the mathematics of it, it has to be.
Right. Now, in addition to the concert at Christmas, there's another special Portland Youth Philharmonic performance coming up in January, and that's the Voices of Light concert. That's on January 26th, again at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. You'll be performing to a live projection of Carl Dreyer's silent film classic, I think 1928, The Passion of Joan of Arc. And it sounds like a very big production. Can you go over a little bit about who's involved in that?
Absolutely. This is the one ensemble in our organization that won't be at the concert at Christmas, Camerata PYP, which is our chamber orchestra. Nobody plays only in that group. It's extracurricular for mostly members of the Portland Youth Philharmonic and occasionally a musician from one of the other ensembles. It'll be an orchestra of about 35 and a large chorus. These are the chorus members from Portland State University under Ethan Sperry, four vocal soloists, and a women's old music ensemble in Mulieribus. So a lot of performers on stage.
All during the film itself?
Yeah. The music was written in the 1990s to accompany this particular film. Richard Einhorn, the composer, saw a print of the film at either the Metropolitan Museum or the Museum of Modern Art. I don't remember which it was. And he was inspired to write this setting of feminist poets and also some of the words of Joan of Arc. Those words are sung by the female ensemble that sing in a chant, old style, to go along with this. The work is quite beautiful and very evocative, but it in no way interferes with the artistic greatness of Carl Dreyer's film, which is a remarkable thing all to itself. I conducted this piece in New York City in 2006, and it was really one of the more dramatic and moving experiences that I've been a part of in orchestral music. I think that Portland audiences will be riveted by this, and it's a one night only, not to be missed thing.
Exactly, not to be missed.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of that, where can listeners find out more about not just this particular concert, but all Portland Youth Philharmonic shows, and then get tickets, especially for the Voices of Light? You don't want to miss out on that.
Right. All of that can be found at our website, which is portlandyouthphil.org. If you just Google Portland Youth Philharmonic, you will find it very quickly. The tickets are sold through links on the websites, and all of that is very good. And incidentally, we have no ticket fees if you buy your tickets online before coming to the hall. So that's a really good way of doing it. And as always, we are one of the great artistic bargains in town. Things are really inexpensive when you consider what artistic things in Portland are costing these days.
Well, David, happy holidays to you first, and thanks very much for coming into KBOO.
Thank you. Same to you, Ken.
We've been talking with David Hattner, musical director of the Portland Youth Philharmonic. They'll be performing their annual concert at Christmas next Tuesday, December 26th at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. The performance starts at 7:30 p.m. For concert details and tickets, you can check out their website, as David said, Portland Youth Phil. That's Portland Youth, P-H-I-L, all one word, .org. I'm Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
The time is 6:03 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Time is now 6:03 p.m. You're listening to Labor Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Nick Bubb, and...
Michael Cathcart.
How are you tonight, Mike?
Doing great. How you doing, Nick?
I'm doing fabulous, but unfortunately, I have to bear some not-so-fabulous news tonight for everybody listening. Among other things, the NLRB has overturned an Obama-era decision.
A number of them, yeah.
A decision that allowed workers at a franchise restaurant to also force to the bargaining table the corporate masters who have much, much deeper pockets.
Yep.
Later on in the episode, we're going to talk about contract workers and the abysmal conditions some of them have at Amazon in the UK. Also, if you have an emergency, who do you think of to call? Do you call 911?
Ghostbusters?
Yeah, Ghostbusters, maybe. It depends on the kind of emergency, I guess. You know, some people might think 911, and some people are like, you know what? I really don't have the $2,000 to scrape up for an ambulance. How about I just summon an Uber?
Yeah, you got the app on your phone? Just call a rideshare. Apparently, that's the new trend.
There we go. Yeah. And finally, we're going to talk about a shocking statistic about the number of union households that voted for Donald Trump.
Got swindled by Donald Trump.
You betcha.
Yeah.
But first, we want to talk about this NLRB decision. What's going on with this?
Yeah, so the National Labor Relations Board is right now, because we have a Republican president, they are under a majority control of Republican board members, and they have, you know, in the same way that the Trump administration has been doing this left and right, they are overturning everything they can get their hands on that the Obama administration had had enacted. So, getting rid of all Obama era statutes that were put in place. In the last couple of weeks, they just went through and overturned three major bits of regulations that they put forward during Obama's administration. The biggest one that we were just talking about is basically decoupling corporate employers from their franchisees.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if a group of employees at a franchise were to, say, have a labor dispute with the owner of that franchise, in under the Obama regulations, if there was a direct link, if they could prove a direct link between the policies being put in place by the franchise and the you know, say we're just as an example, McDonald's, you know, if the franchise owner were enacting policies that they could draw a direct link to the McDonald's corporate policies, then they could bring, you know, when they bring the case to the NLRB, they could link that to the corporate ownership and force them to come to the table to deal with this as well.
Yeah, it seems reasonable to me. I mean, if they're causing it to happen in one store, it's probably there's a chance that it's happening in other stores.
I mean, you would think. But what basically overturning that Obama era regulation now says that even if there is a proven direct link between the franchise owner or the franchisee and the ownership, the corporate ownership, the employees are no longer able to force the corporate ownership to the table with the franchisee when they bring this case to the NLRB, which, you know, has a lot of implications. Probably the most obvious of which is that it really does hurt employees' ability to unionize, to collectively bargain, because the strength in that, you know, comes not only from you and your coworkers at the individual franchise you work at, but also in linking together, as we see with like the 15 Now movement or, you know, the Fight for 15, linking together with workers who are, you know, under the control of different franchise owners, but under the umbrella corporate ownership of a, you know, not to bash on them again, but McDonald's or a company like that.
Yeah.
So it decouples all of these different, all the employees that are McDonald's employees, the way that we as the customer sees them, but from their actual employment are employees of that franchise. And so it decouples them from each other, therefore isolating the employees at each individual franchise and forcing them to form a union that is only as strong as the people at that particular franchise.
Right, potentially you could have unions at different McDonald's represented by different unions, having different standards, different working conditions, different wages.
Yeah, and if you have, you know, I don't know what the typical staff at a fast food restaurant is, the number of staff, but say it's 15 employees, 20 employees.
I think at a McDonald's, it's considerably more than that. I worked at one when I was younger, and we probably had closer to 50.
Wow. Yeah, I guess there are a lot of shifts, and, you know, people work part-time and stuff. But either way, like, if you know, you at max, you have 50 employees at one McDonald's.
Exactly.
That is the strength of your union there. It's not the 150 at the different stores around town, or, you know, the thousands at the different stores around the country. It's the 50 right. within your particular store. And so that significantly weakens what you bring, you know, how your footing at the bargaining table, and what you're likely able to receive from the ownership.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that's a completely different game when you're a group of 50 people bargaining with a franchisee that maybe that could even be their first store. So they might be heavily in debt. They might be trying to pay off loans. I mean, there's not a whole lot of concessions to give. But if you join together as a group, the corporate is well established. They've got tons of money.
Oh, yeah. I mean, whatever corporation you're talking about, if it's, you know, if it's one that is at the point where they're franchising out locations, then they likely are very well off.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it's a real tragedy in that regard. And there are a few other implications of it. I mean, another thing that the NLRB under the leadership of the Republican majority just overturned in the last couple weeks is they basically struck down an Obama era regulation that allowed for micro unionizing within workplaces. So instead of, you know, requiring that everyone within the workplace joins the union in order for the union to be validated, you know, you could have four or five employees band together and collectively bargain, even though there may be more employees at that location or within that company. They are able to form a micro union within the workforce.
Wow. Okay.
And so that was just the right to do that was just overturned, because, you know, that's a pretty big gift from the NLRB to employers like the National Restaurant Association,
right.
Things like that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, like if you had a big enough establishment, you own a building, for example.
Yeah.
You might have five or six janitors.
Right.
You know, and if they decide to band together, even though the rest of the building doesn't want anything to do with it, they could form their own union and then bargain with you.
Yeah. I mean, like the janitors have different working conditions than the, you know, the folks who do the electrical work or any other, you know, whatever other employees in that building are, and they see fit to band together, they could form a micro union. But at this point, they are now no longer allowed to do that.
They'd have to get the whole building involved. Right. They have to get all everybody from the ground up, not just the janitors, the administrators,
exactly.
And the hall monitors, you know, whatever they have these days.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, the argument made by ownership, you know, by the employer side of it, is that allowing those unions creates, you know, fractures the workforce, and it creates a divided workforce. But you know, that's not necessarily true, because if you think about the reality that if you don't allow them to unionize, if you crack down on that, then it creates a completely fractured work environment where it's every single individual for themselves,
right.
Divided against each other for what they can get. And so, you know, you talk about fracturing the workplace, disallowing them from banding together is completely fracturing it into a million pieces.
Yeah. Yeah, no. So, I mean, that is a big gift. And it's funny because, like, when you're thinking about the NLRB, I mean, you think of, like, okay, this must be a huge group making these decisions. It's five people.
Right.
It's split. This vote came along party lines 3-2.
Mm-hmm.
It's five people who, you know, who knows what all their pasts are. Like, you know, net neutrality just went away, and Ajit Pai is, what was he in a past life?
He was in a very recent past life,
yeah.
a Verizon lobbyist, a lawyer for Verizon. One of the main companies pushing for the end of net neutrality, and also standing to benefit from the end of net neutrality. So,
all right.
You know, it's not only true that politicians, there's a revolving door for politicians when they help deregulate agencies. It's also true for regulators,
yeah.
You know, bureaucrat regulators in the same way. I mean, we saw that even in the Obama administration, Chairman Wheeler, whose first name I'm forgetting right now.
Tom
Wheeler. There we go. Yeah. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
But he, you know, he had previously been a lobbyist for, I believe it was Comcast or one of the other telecoms.
Yeah,
and replaced Michael Steele, who went from regulating the FCC into a lobbyist position with one of the other telecom companies. And so they just literally switched positions.
He'll switcheroo.
Yeah. So we see that happen in every level of government. And it's not surprising that Ajit Pai, or, you know, that anyone in his position would come from the industry that they're regulating,
right.
An administration that clearly favors ownership and management over workers.
Speaking of net neutrality, I mean, we didn't even tease this one at the beginning of the show, but I feel like it's worth a few moments to mention. Like, if you're listening, they've overturned net neutrality, which has always been the standard since the beginning of the internet, but it wasn't until 2015 when companies are like, you know what, FCC, you know what, people who have managed the internet, we don't care about your culture, we're in it for profits, so we're going to start creating our own internet fast lanes, and you don't have the authority to stop us. And that's when they were given the authority, and that's when they enacted rules to actually make it official. Net neutrality is the standard. That's been overturned. And if you don't know what net neutrality is, it means, okay, so you as a customer have purchased a certain amount of bandwidth for your internet. You know, maybe it's 40 megabytes a second, and you get to choose how to spend that. It doesn't matter if you're going to Costco.com, Amazon.com. It doesn't matter if you're going to other more nefarious websites that we won't mention. It's your bandwidth. Spend it however you want.
Exactly.
Well, the telecom companies have realized, you know what, if we could just, and I would call this, you know, in my opinion, it seems like extorting. Mm-hmm. But they get to say, okay, well, you know, if you want your website to go faster and have your user have a better experience, you're going to have to cough up a couple $1 million. You know, otherwise, for example, Netflix. You know, if you want your customers to be able to watch your movies without it pausing and buffering, you're going to have to cough up, you know, $10, $20, $100 million for our special internet fast lanes. And if they don't, then it affects you as a user. And even though you've already paid, you're like, hey, I've paid for my bandwidth. Why are you holding this up? But by repealing net neutrality, that gives them the right to do this. Yeah. And they're trying to say now that, oh, no, just, you know, that's not our goal here. Then I have to ask, why have they spent millions of dollars lobbying for it?
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, like, their argument that you hear from the telecom companies that are clearly going to benefit from this is that, well, look, I mean, just because we are now given the right to do this doesn't mean we're going to do it. I mean, that would be crazy.
Right.
But as you just said, what's crazy is to think that they would have spent millions of dollars and years lobbying on this to the point where they actually, you know, stacked the deck in the FCC in their favor.
Yeah.
Just to win the victory and do nothing with it.
Right.
Like, why, if they don't plan to do anything with what they're being handed here, then why fight for it at all? Why ask for that? Yeah.
And so that's crazy. And so how this ties into the labor movement is, if you want to start a business, a company, if you even want to just do some commission work and you have your own website, well, you've got customers now that would like to go to your website, but it loads so painfully slow that they give up and they go to another site because that site has coughed up millions of dollars to the telecom companies.
Yeah, and I mean, you'll see things like if you are... And I think in the field that we're operating in right now, I mean, journalism is an area that I think will really be affected. I mean, obviously, you can look at it from, you know, startup companies and all sorts of other things, but access to information and access to dissenting points of view, and information that doesn't necessarily benefit the people who are the gatekeepers of the internet, that's really where I mean, I'm scared in a lot of regards, but I think that's the scariest aspect of it, is that if you, say, are an independent journalist who runs a website that does hard-hitting journalism but is not necessarily speaking well of Verizon or of, you know, Comcast or one of those companies, it's pretty likely that under this system...
Put the brakes on it.
Yeah, like, you just won't appear in search results.
Sure.
Because they will throttle what you're providing in favor of, you know, the Washington Post or something like that.
And then obviously there's the other cost involved, and that's if Netflix now has to pay $100 million to Comcast and more money to Verizon and more money to AT&T and everybody else along the way, is your $8.99 Netflix subscription going to go up? Absolutely.
Yeah.
That money, I mean, they don't have a printing press. They don't just get to print that money. They got to get it from somewhere, and that's going to come from my pockets, your pockets, and anybody, you know, that's got a Netflix subscription.
Yeah. And it also, you know, just this week we're seeing the merger of Disney and Fox News, or sorry, Fox, everything but Fox News.
The Fox Corporation.
20th Century Fox. Or I guess it's 21st Century
$52
now.
$52 billion.
Yeah. But, you know, you're going to see the consolidation of the media outlets, of the media companies, providers. And then, you know, anyone who is not a big big company in that field is just going to be squeezed out entirely because they aren't going to. There's not going to be a level playing field for them to get their content out there to the same viewers and have that, you know, have the viewers choose what they want to consume. And you know, there's so much that can be said about it, but I think one of the most ridiculous aspects of it is that the argument made in favor of overturning net neutrality by these telecom companies is that it, you know, right now net neutrality, this decision that came about a couple of years ago through the Obama administration, it's in their eyes, it's government overreach. It's government stifling the free market on the internet, and it's constraining, you know, the free market on the internet. And this is freeing up the internet, you know, repealing net neutrality is freeing it up and creating a truly free market within the internet.
Right.
Which is absurd, because the only way that it's a free market is if you're looking at it simply from the point of view of the telecom companies, the folks who are the gatekeepers. You know, if you're talking about the actual ability to operate with online, how is it possibly a free market when you have when not all content on there is carried equally?
Right.
You know, the free market would be everyone is allowed to put their information, their content out there, allow you to access it, and then people choose based on what they think is best. But a constrained market would be saying, all right, you have access to only these certain sites, and if you want those other sites, you have to pay more. So, oh, you're poor, you can't access that. That stuff's out of reach for you.
Right.
And then the gatekeepers get to choose what you're able to access. That is not a free market. That is the opposite of that. So it's an absurd argument that they have yet to be able to truly substantially back up.
And I read an article this week. I'm not going to the Comcast website regularly, but apparently they have their commitment to net neutrality on their website. And as soon as this decision they took it down.
Of course they
gone.
Did. Not a surprise. It's like the day that the Trump administration took over and the EPA's website got rid of all mention of climate change.
Right. Yeah. And what's the one now where they pseudo banned the words science based?
Yeah. There's a whole list of words in classic dictator fashion. There's a whole list of words that is it the CDC or is it the EPA? There's a government agency banned from using a list of words, one of which is science based.
Right.
Another one is fetus. I mean, there's a number of words that they aren't allowed to use anymore. And like, I'm sorry, but how much more like a dictator can you be if you ban the use of certain words?
Right.
You know, I mean, I understand banning obscenities. Like, you know, obviously that makes certain sense. But banning the use of science-based or of terms that are used regularly within a intellectual field, that's insane. I mean, that's literally the stuff of dictators.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's a person to do? So now we've got the NLRB repeal. We've got net neutrality that we're up against. We haven't talked about the Amazon drivers yet.
That is true.
And this is something important to talk about. Now, this takes place in the UK, our neighbors across the pond.
Yeah.
But it's an American company. It's Amazon.
And you can bet that if it's happening over there, it's either happening here and we don't know about it, or it's soon to happen here.
Right.
Yeah.
I hope somebody working at Amazon calls in. What's our number to call in? Is it 503-231-8187? I think that sounds right. Call that number if you work at Amazon. Or if you're a contract worker anywhere, actually. We want to hear about your working conditions.
Yeah, especially if you're an Amazon driver. But really, if you are if you're a contract worker anywhere, it's 503-231-8187.
Bingo.
Yeah, nicely done. But
thank you.
So in the UK, we're seeing a situation where Amazon workers... I think we actually have a caller right now.
Ooh, really? It's fabulous.
That was incredibly fast.
Hello, how are you tonight?
I'm fine, thank you. I have a call which may seem a little off the mark, but really it's related.
Awesome.
That if we want to maintain our privacy and our communication, we must maintain the post office, because I believe that will be their next target.
Absolutely.
If we lose the internet and we lose the post office, we lose the last bastion of privacy that we actually have.
I think you are right on the mark with that.
Yeah.
I mean,
in other words, we need all kinds of alternatives. We need the digital and we need the analog.
Mm-hmm.
And we should not lull ourselves into thinking that we can get rid of the post office and still communicate with each other.
What do you think about Bernie Sanders' plan? He had suggested that it would be a good idea to revitalize the economic... the economy of the post office by allowing banking to happen at the post office as well.
I don't know. I haven't thought about that. But the post office is good. It provides really good jobs for people.
Mm-hmm. Union jobs.
Absolutely.
Let it be privatized. We need the public institutions, and we need the old-fashioned ones to sit alongside anything else. And we also need to invent new things that Trump and those guys don't understand and don't know how to use.
Exactly. Trump, they don't know how to privatize.
We don't need it anymore. We need to invent something else.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And maintain our privacy. Privacy is freedom. Thank you. That's my message.
Thank you for calling in.
Have a good night.
And I think you're spot on with that in the sense that, you know, if not only we're talking about Amazon here, but if we get rid of the post office, all of a sudden, we have a situation where the only folks who carry parcels
are private companies. Exactly. That's right. And then wouldn't you know it, their prices would go up and quickly.
And the post office provides good union jobs that folks can work on through their entire career and retire on.
They do.
And Amazon does not provide that.
No.
FedEx does not provide that.
Do they provide bottles to their truck drivers? Did you finish telling that story?
No, yeah. So in the UK, which is, you know, obviously it's not this country, but you can imagine that if it happens there, it's probably happening here too. But the folks who deliver Amazon packages are contract workers. And they are given a certain number of parcels they need to deliver within a certain time frame. And because they're contract workers, the company says, well, here is your route. You need to get this done. It's because you're a contractor, you get to do it at your pace and make it happen. Now, because they're given an unachievable goal every single day.
200 packages a day.
Exactly. Which, you know, if it is.
I did the math on an 8-hour shift. That's a package every 2.4 minutes. That includes their drive time, their get out of the truck and put it on your porch time. Every 2.4 minutes, a package must be delivered.
And that doesn't account for traffic. That doesn't account for the fact that the houses aren't right next door to each other.
Bathroom breaks, and that's only if they skip breaks and skip lunch.
Skip everything.
That's 8 hours. That's 200 packages over 8 hours every 2.4 minutes.
But so the workers there are getting in trouble because they're walking around with water bottles or plastic bottles filled with urine, and the reason is because they are because as Nick just described, there is no time within their schedule to take a bathroom break, and therefore they have to do what they can, and they carry bottles with them, and they relieve themselves on the job in order to continue moving.
We had the same problem when I was in the Middle East.
Oh, yeah.
Dude, we're staying in these Connex boxes raised up on cinder blocks, and anytime that we wanted to leave to go to walk to the bathroom, the idea is that we make ourselves a hard target. If we are always difficult to attack, then they will be less likely to attack us. It's actually pretty sound reasoning, but at 3 a.m. when you wake up because you have to go pee and your CO is now requiring you to put on your full uniform, all of your armor, just to go to the bathroom, what ended up happening was guys started
peeing
in bottles and then chucking them under the Connex boxes until the health inspection discovered one guy had like 200 of them under his Connex box,
man.
And then we all felt the pain, unfortunately. But yeah, so I sympathize greatly for these Amazon workers.
And like, it's one thing if you're in a war zone, if it has to that regular, you know, if you're forced to do it because it's either get up and take 5 minutes to put on all your gear and then run out or just pee right there.
Right.
But it's another thing if you're on your regular job and even though you should be allowed to take regular bathroom breaks, you don't have time for that.
Right. Because you're a contract worker. So if you know, like you and I were talking before the show, and you're like, you know, so if you don't deliver the 200 packages and you're an employee, you're like, sorry, boss, I tried my best. I was really hustling.
Yeah.
I had to go to the bathroom. You know, maybe you stop there and use the bathroom one time.
You're allowed your 15 minute breaks, your 30 minute lunch break. You know?
Yeah. Here you're a contractor, and your contract states you will deliver 200 packages, and they don't care how long it takes you. You get the same pay.
Yeah, and if you don't do it, then you're in breach of contract, and you are liable to have that contract terminated.
Yep.
Which, you know, is part of, you know, that's just one microcosm of the issues that come from the increasing contractualization of the workforce, you know, taking workers out of the protections of being full employees of a company and making them contract workers, which allows companies to skirt any sort of employee regulations, you know, the things that have been fought so hard for by unionized workers and you know, politicians and labor activists for so long. And I just I got a note here that earlier I was mentioning, you know, we were talking about Trump banning the use of certain words, and I wasn't sure which agency it was. It's actually the CDC.
It is the CDC, yes.
Yeah, using the term science-based.
Why would we want the Center for Disease Control to be science-based?
Right, that would be crazy. It should be, you know, it should be gut feeling based. It should be emotionally based. So thank you, Kat Morrison, for letting me know about that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm reading here that for these 200 packages a day, they might receive 160 pounds. So I'm not sure the current exchange rate. It's always less than $2 to a pound, though.
Yeah.
And, by the way, that's not for one day. That is for their week of delivering 200 packages a day.
And that doesn't even include the price for the bottles that they're using, you know?
Yeah.
Like, where are they finding bottles big enough?
Yeah, no kidding.
But yeah, I mean...
Maybe they're getting them dirt cheap off Amazon.
Yeah.
That guy's got more money than anybody now, too.
He's the richest man in the world, and he owns one of the newspapers of record in this country.
Which one?
He owns the Washington Post.
Does he?
Which
does
is
really?
One of the most revered news outlets in the country.
Huh.
And it is owned by...
Probably won't
the
be
man who almost owns the internet. Like 50% of internet traffic goes through Amazon. Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that either.
So like that's a sleeping giant.
I don't think you'll be reading this article on the Washington Post.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Well, unless you believe the conspiracy theories, they say maybe Vladimir Putin's got more money.
Oh.
But of official record, Jeff Bezos tops the list.
At least of Americans. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's crazy to think that he owns a newspaper, a media outlet that's supposed to be objective and fair and balanced, and yet it clearly, when put to the test, op-ed, you know, articles in there constantly side with the ownership side of things, management sides of things.
All right, well... It is now, unfortunately, 6:30,
wow,
but we started
speeds.
The news came into our time by 3 minutes, so I think that we actually get to recover our 3 minutes now, and we did promise that we would talk about people who voted for Donald Trump, people who were, as I believe I heard, duped.
Yeah, I think duped, swindled, conned, any of those terms work pretty well for, I mean, obviously there's definitely a contingent of people out there who knew exactly what they were voting for and chose to cast that vote. But I think likely a large portion, if not a majority of people who voted for Mr. Trump in the general election did so because they were convinced of things that he may have, you know, some lies that he may have spewed on the campaign trail that they bought into and didn't bother to look anywhere past the sheen of, you know, him being a reality TV star,
right.
them seeing him on the TV, you know.
Yeah, right. Oh, I know that fella.
I seen him on the TV.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so, you know, it's shocking considering what we're seeing the Trump administration, you know, with this NLRB stuff that we've been talking about and all the other attacks on organized labor and on workers.